Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, migratory birds have begun their journey back to Wisconsin, and today we'll be talking about the birds you might be able to spot this time of year, and we'll also talk about how to make your yard more bird-friendly with our guest, Bill Volker, back with us. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at Horican Marsh for 27 years and has been watching birds for well over 40. So he brings a lot of knowledge, and I'm glad to have him back with us. What would you like to know about attracting birds to your yard, perhaps? What questions do you have about feeding birds? Have you seen birds that you generally don't see in your area? Join in. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email or a photo as well, bird photo, to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always nice to be with you and also your many, many listeners.
Well, spring migration has begun. And let's talk about first, which birds are the ones that arrive early and maybe why? Why do some arrive later? Let's talk about that.
Sure. Well, first of all, when we talk about spring migration, it really begins in about mid to late February and doesn't end until almost June. So we're talking about nearly a quarter of the year being spring migration. But during that time, different groups of birds are moving at different times. And as you mentioned here, the earliest ones to arrive, they're responding to the melting snow. So as soon as our snow starts to recede, the uplands become available for feeding areas. That food is uncovered. So Canada geese, red-winged blackbirds, the grackles, robins, and sandhill cranes are some of the earliest ones to arrive. And they've been here now in much of Wisconsin for a couple of weeks. Also, our lakes are starting to open up in parts of southern Wisconsin. Quite a few wetlands and lakes are now ice-free. Others, it's receding quickly, and that open water is attracting waterfowl. I took a drive over toward Horican Marsh yesterday to meet with someone on a writing project we're working on, and that is all ice-free, and I found over a dozen species of ducks, several different kinds of geese, white-fronted snow geese, and Canada geese. They were all within at least that larger area beyond Horican. So that's really what's attracting them. And very soon now, we'll start to see the first of the songbirds coming back. The eastern phoebe is always an early migrant. The bluebirds, they'll be coming fairly soon. That's a relative to our robin. Robins are back already. The bluebirds will be right behind them. And as we get into the middle part of April, with the warmer temperatures, we'll see the first insect hatch. That'll bring back the tree swallows, the yellow-rumped warblers, blue-gray gnatcatchers, towhees, some of these early songbirds. And then the big wave really comes in those first 2 to 3 weeks of May. That's when we always see the orioles, hummingbirds, and the warblers, flycatchers, and a lot of the summer birds, and that peak of spring migration, birds that are heading even into Canada for nesting. That's when they finally arrive. And, of course, they're mostly insectivores. So we need a good insect food crop to really bring them back. So it's all about food, and they all eat different things. And as that season slowly thaws out of winter and takes us into that more summer-like weather, different kinds of food becomes available for different groups of birds.
Yeah. You mentioned the eastern phoebe, and I think Christina Myshock, our engineer, has maybe the song of the eastern phoebe. Christina, have you got that?
And you can hear that's where he got his name from.
You sure can.
It's reminiscent of a phoebe. So a lot of birds are named for the sound of their calls and songs. And phoebes are one of our flycatchers. Most flycatchers really don't migrate until that very last part of April and early May. But the phoebe tends to come out and come up here before the rest, and is a local nesting bird in much of Wisconsin. And the flycatchers really don't have extremely complex songs, and it has to do with the structure of that so-called vocal cords. They're much more simplified, but that's it. It's just a simple Phoebe, a little raspy call, and we should be hearing that within probably the next 2 weeks or so. We'll see what the progress of the weather is.
One bird that I've been hearing a lot are the is the cardinal, and cardinals they're common in both rural and urban areas. Christina, maybe you've got a cardinal call for. I love the call for some reason; it's a favorite of mine. Have you got that, Christina?
Easily recognized too.
Yeah.
Finding that one.
That one was not the cardinal.
Okay,
but
we'll give her a
that's
minute.
All right.
Well,
that. Yeah,
I are not migratory. That's a year-round
right.
resident. Oh, here we go. Starting to hear it.
Yeah, there it is.
It's a nice, clear whistle. There's a lot of variation in it, but it's more the quality of the voice. So if you listen closely enough to cardinals, there's quite a little variation on the theme, so to speak. They've got a lot of different, somewhat similar vocalizations, but it's all that clear whistle. And they actually started to sing the latter part of January, early February, when we first get those somewhat longer days and that first little bit of melting of snow, they'll start tuning up already. And as I just said a bit ago, that's a non-migratory bird. It's a year-round resident. So they're around our feeders all winter long. And then as we start to get even that first couple of days of a little bit longer sunshine, the cardinals start tuning up already, and it'll be a common song all throughout the neighborhoods for the next several months.
Yeah, I enjoy hearing it on my morning jogs through the neighborhood for sure. We should take a question. George in Okauchee, let's go to you. George, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me on. I worked at a restaurant on Okauchee Lake, the Golden Mask, and every year we have a single loon that stops by and visits us just for a couple of weeks. And I always wonder about that loon's story, because I have heard they mate for life, and his call in the morning sometimes here is very eerie. It's beautiful, but he's only here for a couple weeks, and I just wonder how long they live, and if they mate for life, maybe he's like a widowed loon. Anyway, if you have some answers for me, that'd be great.
All right, thanks for calling. What about it, Bill?
Well, excuse me, he mentioned the Phoebe. Is that correct? I didn't quite
loon.
Hear that. Oh, the loon.
The loon.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, pardon me. Yeah, thank you. Loons are nesting primarily in the northern third, and the nesting population has been establishing itself a little farther south into central Wisconsin on the lakes. So for those of us living in the southern part of the state, it's migrant only. And those lakes, of course, open sooner, so they're making their way north. I've actually seen loons sitting on lakes where barely one quarter of the lake is ice-free. Everything else is still frozen, and there's the first loon sitting on it already. So they basically are moving as quickly as that water opens up. And I've even seen loons flying overhead as if they're surveying the area to see if there's any open water and perhaps make a little bit of a circle to something that they can rest on where there is a place to rest and feed any open water that is available. So they need some deeper lakes. They're, of course, entirely living on the fish. And the loons are then stopping over until the northern lakes open up. Now, if we look back in the historic records of the late 1800s, early 1900s, nesting loons were reported on large lakes all across southern Wisconsin and even northern Illinois. But as people know, loons need to have undisturbed areas. And as we've developed so many of our lakes, basically we moved in and they moved out. And that's why Project Loon Watch has become such an important thing for those people who vacation or actually live in northern Wisconsin. We know that they need to have some space and some lack of disturbance. And so where we do know of nesting loons, we try to warn people at the boat landings and to give them some room. They are a fairly long-lived bird, and they will mate for life or certainly for the length of any partner. There may be some exchange of partners occasionally on these lakes, but it's a real typical bird of the North Woods. And
George was saying
Southern Wisconsin for a while.
Yeah, George was saying he sees this loon every year, but it's always by itself, and he thought they mated for life.
Yes, interesting. They do, but basically they may migrate individually. So they'll go to the southern states or just off the Gulf Coast in the southern United States or the South Atlantic states and winter out there, and they'll migrate back independently. But basically, the mated pair go back to the same lake. So they'll meet up eventually. They're not like, say, Canada geese, that they stay together. But the difference there is Canada geese, that first, just like cranes, that first year, they're taking the young with them, teaching them the route, and then bringing them back. Then they chase them out and start the next family. Loons, the young, once they start to become full grown or more independent in late summer and migrate independently of the adults, and the adults may go separate ways through the wintertime to find their own little fishing grounds and then meet up again on that same lake the following year.
Let's take another call. Pat in Cottage Grove, I believe it's your turn. Pat, hi. Thank you for calling.
I have been feeding birds off of our deck for 42 years, and this year I have not had any goldfinches. I changed the feeders, the Niger seed, thinking maybe it was old, and I just haven't seen any. I just wondered if anybody else is having that concern or whether there's a reason you could tell me.
Well, finches are all somewhat nomads. We had a nice movement of pine siskins come through Wisconsin early in the fall, actually late summer already, and they seem to be spending the winter in southern states. And I've heard from other birders, there seems to be a bit of a lack of goldfinches this year around parts of the state, and it seems that perhaps they've moved to other places. This is the time of year as we get into that end of March and the first couple of weeks of April, where the males will start to slowly change color. So I think we're also going to be seeing the return of those birds as they're going through that molt and seeking out those traditional nesting grounds. But these are year-round birds, but they're also nomadic. And I believe that perhaps they just have moved out of our area. We'll see what comes back for the summertime and if they reestablish themselves in their old haunts again. I would expect
there so. You go. There you go, Pat. Thank you so much for calling. And Fred in Menominee, your turn. Hi, Fred.
Well, hi. I just this year got interested in making some bluebird boxes because we had a bluebird nesting in a grapevine last year. So I went to the Cornell lab and they said to site the boxes a certain way. And then there was a guy from Wisconsin who sounded like he knew a lot, and he said site the nesting boxes. So he was suggesting having the hole point northeast. Cornell lab was saying have it point south. So do you have any ideas about bluebird boxes? And also, does Wisconsin have in Pennsylvania, they have a group that catalogs the bluebird nests and how many fledglings they get, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder if Wisconsin has the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. Yes, actually, we do have a very similar organization. They've been around for many, many years now. It is the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, BRAW. They have a very good website, and you'll find bird house designs there, mm-hmm. placement, and how to monitor them. And this is important to monitor them because we will have, as you put your boxes out, the chance for other birds to use it. Might be house wren, might even be chickadees if it's near some trees and bushes. Could be tree swallows, which also need a good home. Their populations have been showing some decline. Or it could be house sparrows, which we don't want in those boxes as a non-native bird. And there are some good hints of how to monitor your boxes and how to manage them. As far as your placement, yeah, to the northeast or to the south, really what they're suggesting is don't point it to the west. The main reason for that is because most of our storms come from the west. You'll get rain driven into there, and especially those early rains for the young nestlings, it could lead to some hypothermia and soaking of them. So, yeah, you just want to turn it away from the wind. You also don't want to put it right near bushes. Keep it a little bit of a distance. If you do have any trees or shrubs, you might want to point that hole so it's somewhat to there so that when the young jump the nest, they've got a target where to fly where they can perch then and find some safety that very first day that they're out of the nest. But you'll find all those recommendations on the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. Check their website. There'll be some great hints there. And thanks so much for managing bluebirds.
Yeah, and also the Restoration Association of Wisconsin, before June 1st of this year, if you join, I think it's $25 for their annual level, they will send you free 2 to 5 nest boxes with predator guards and clamps. You'll also get an instruction book on how to locate and put up boxes. There's a 4-issue subscription to the Wisconsin Bluebird newsletter. And, of course, there, as Bill was talking about, too, there's some advice from experienced bluebirders as you need that information. But if you want some new boxes and you don't want to bother with making them yourself, they're offering 2 to 5 nest boxes for free when you join at that annual $25 level. So that's the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, BRAW. Well, Bill Volkert,
a chance to give a little plug for them. Great.
Yeah, it was a good chance. So I took it. I'll tell you what. Definitely. Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Fun talking with him about birds. You have a question. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Jenna Rose Schleiss, our producer today, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at spring bird migration on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volkert. Maybe you've had some bird sightings, some unusual ones. I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We've had some good calls already, and there's certainly a line open for you, so I hope you join in with your own comments. David called to ask, what type of birdhouses work well in the northern part of the state?
Oh, good question. A couple of things. If you are in areas of some of the farmland, pasture land openings in the north woods, bluebird boxes will work very well up there. So that depends, of course. If you're in the woods, it's not going to. Also, a lot of lakes up there. Purple martins is another one that certainly needs help. And there is a Purple Martin Conservation Association. You can check their website. They've got some really good hints on how to establish a house and monitor it. And in the eastern United States, purple martins are 100% dependent on humans to provide housing and to manage for them. And the same problem as with our bluebirds, the house sparrows and starlings are enemy number one for them, and the two are just not compatible. You cannot have both of these non-native birds and the purple martins there. You will lose your colony, and the general rule of thumb is they're really hard to attract, but they're easy to lose. So they require then intervention. Those people who do have houses, you've got to manage those to keep them going. And then those who like to lure them in, it may take a little while to attract them, but it's certainly going to be worthwhile. So those are two suggestions. You could try woodduck boxes, which are also used by hooded mergansers and some other cavity nesters. Those are either right on the edge of water or over water. I put up a few new ones this year. If you're going to do them over water, best time is a few weeks ago for us in southern Wisconsin when we still had ice to walk on. It's a lot easier to try to do that kind of work when you're on a solid platform than trying to do it out of a canoe. And now there are a few other boxes you can check. The Northern Prairie Conservation Association, they had a whole series of nest box designs. And if you just check on the web, there's a lot of different for barred owls. People even tried them for flickers, which normally excavate their own home. The bluebird home we talked about may be also utilized by a number of other songbird species, some of the cavity nesters. And something else to consider, that the bird houses we put up are really substitutes for what were always the dead trees. So for those with woodlots, that dead tree or snag management is also important. Keep those standing, leave them some up there for excavation of food and also to create their cavities as natural nest sites.
Good points. Just had a call from a listener who said the blue box houses are out of stock right now, but I'm expecting that they'll be back in stock fairly soon. So I wanted to mention that.
Well, Leisha, your announcement, Larry, they're probably going to go quickly as soon as they get them again.
Yeah, they're probably going to be getting a lot of calls, and good, actually. That's good.
Not a bad thing, is it, now? People want to help birds. That's great.
Leisha in Spring Green, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hi. About a week and a half ago, I was looking out my kitchen window, and where I watch birds all the time, in a tree that's about 20 feet away, and there was a black bird, and I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. And because it wasn't a junco, as obviously they're not black, but anyway, it had on its wing, it was red and white. And then I looked it up, and I'm like, they're only on the West Coast, so how could that possibly be?
Oh, red and white on the wing?
Yeah.
Red-winged blackbird, and I know this is an extremely common bird for us. It's actually a red patch, that epaulette, surrounded by a border of pretty light-colored yellow, but under certain lighting, it can look quite white. Yeah, and the West Coast is the tricolored blackbird, where it is white. But that yellow, you know, under certain lighting can be quite bright. And I used to get the question a lot from people, why is it that some red-winged blackbirds have all red on the wing and others have just that little bit of yellow? Well, when they're on their nesting territory, they are both singing to establish and claim the territory, to keep other males out and to try to allure the females when they arrive. But when they're off of those territories, and especially now when they're migrating in flocks and heading north for some of those birds, as they associate with others, they don't want to arouse that aggressive behavior out of others, so they cover up the red, and all you see is just that little stripe of yellow. But as I say, that yellow is really quite a bright yellow. It can look more whitish on it, but red-winged blackbird. And they're coming through right now in big numbers, both those that are settling into the marshes and roadsides in southern Wisconsin, and big flocks that are staging right now, getting ready to head much farther north.
Thank you, Leisha. Appreciate it. Joel in East Troy, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, hi, it's nice to be here. So I'm a snowbird. We just came back from Florida, and coming along with us seemed to be the sandhill cranes. We had a number of them down in our community in southwest Florida, and now I'm starting to see them return to the fields and estuaries around our lake home. And I wanted to know a little bit more about their lives and how long they live. And I believe that they mate for life, but I'd like just a little more information about them.
Okay, yeah, great question. There are two subspecies of sandhill cranes in North America, the greater and lesser. And, of course, the greater is the bigger of the two. The greater is the one we have here in Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, that Great Lakes area. And so that's their nesting area from there into southern Canada. Wintering grounds, well, they go as far south as they need to. Some of them may be hanging out in Kentucky, Tennessee to get beyond the snow line. Others will go down to southern Georgia and that north central Florida area. So that's their winter site. The lesser sandhill crane is coming up the plains and going into that area of the North Dakota, South Central Canada. Some of them may go all the way up toward Alaska. Those are the birds that are staging on the Platte River. And as we get into this third week of March, that's always been the traditional crane festival, which, like so many outdoor events, has been postponed considering the pandemic. But those are the large numbers of cranes, with 750,000 staging in Nebraska. They winter down in Texas, New Mexico, and into northern Mexico. So they're coming up that direction. Now, cranes will mate for life, but they do not mature until they're about 4 or 5 years old. So as I said earlier, the young stay with the parents for that first year of life. And what you will commonly notice is a family may be migrating up here. So you might see 3 or 4 birds together as they get onto territory. And then as the adults are starting to settle in, they'll chase that young out. And sometimes you'll see a young flying around by itself, They'll be calling out there, and eventually they'll get together with others to form the non-breeding flocks. So they'll be hanging out together then for that summertime until they finally mature. But you'll see them flying around and calling as if, you know, mom just doesn't like me anymore. And the cranes that are on the breeding ground, I've got a pair actually right near our house. And they go out to feed right now, putting on some weight for that egg production, and then settle into the what will be their nesting territory. And when any other crane flies by, they let them know that they've already claimed this area, and you'll hear them calling. And they do what is called a unison call, or some people refer to it as duetting. So you'll hear this, and pardon my really bad imitation, but it'll be a ooh, ah, ooh, ah. And so this is male-female, back and forth. And what that's doing is not just announcing that territory to other cranes, but it's also part of the courtship, or since they're a pair for life, it is that reinforcement of the pair bond. And so they will be calling and dancing. And it literally, not only then is a behavioral thing to say, renew their commitments or their vows, so to speak, to put it in human terms, but it actually causes the female to come into ovulation so that she can produce viable eggs. And this was discovered at the International Crane Foundation when they tried to do artificial breeding of whooping cranes. Just simply trying to do the artificial insemination didn't work until George Archibald literally went into the pen, slept with and danced with Tex, the crane that really kind of made him and the bird itself famous, and realizing that he had to dance and get her excited and going so that she was physically receptive to that. And so, yeah, the cranes, they can be quite long-lived. They may live 10, 15 years. The biggest mortality for a lot of these is the destruction of the nest, things like raccoons or other mammals getting in, though they can be quite aggressive, especially a tall bird with that beak. And there may be accidents and losses of those birds through the migration is always the biggest hazard.
And we, Christina has the call of the sandhill crane. You did a pretty nice job on that, Bill. But
yeah,
Christina,
well,
Christina, have you got the call of the sandhill crane? There we go. That's one of the types of calls. Of
right. That's the one individual. Correct. That's a contact call from them. Yeah, you'll hear that from a lone crane or, you know, a single one. Or as we say, when they get on the nesting grounds, then they hear that duetting call as well. So it's really a wonderful sound of spring, isn't it?
Yeah, it is indeed. Joel, thank you so much. Al in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. I have a quick question about orioles. We live on a small lake, and they come in the spring, and they won't stick around. We put out, like, jelly feeders and that, but they just don't stick around. So I'm wondering what we can do to keep them there.
Okay. Well, orioles build, of course, that basket-like nest. It's literally a woven nest. And so they need some tall trees with these somewhat drooping, sweeping limbs on them. They like to put it way out on the end because that's pretty free of predators. Nothing's going to be able to climb out there on these fine twigs that can support the weight of anything. And by the way, even squirrels are known to raid bird nests. So you put them out on those little twigs, that pretty well keeps everyone at bay. So you need to have some large shade trees. The American elm at one time was a very common, very popular large shade tree for them. Of course, Dutch elm disease is keeping the size of those trees down as that cycles around. Other trees that they will use include things such as silver maple, birch trees, and I've seen them in a variety of other trees where they have built their nests. But the large shade tree is really the most important thing as a nest site. Baltimore oriole, right around May 1st is about the time we see them come. Like always, spring tends to come a little earlier, a little later each year, or more commonly has this sort of start and stop, a little bit of a pause with the progress. So that first week of May, they tend to arrive about the same time as the hummingbirds. So as we get into those last few days of April, jelly feeders, pieces of oranges or whatever, or orange halves, whatever you have for the orioles, put that out. And then I would suggest taking a look at your backyard. Of course, it's going to take a while to grow a mature shade tree, but we can plan well in advance to try to make our backyards more bird friendly. Some of this can be achieved in a season or two. Some of it is more of a long range plan for some of the bigger trees that we might want to plant. But now is a good time to really start thinking about planting in for birds.
Yeah, I had a Baltimore Oriole nest on the in the birch tree in my back lawn of my previous house. I was surprised at how, even after it was no longer in use, how long it survived. Some pretty tough weather.
For a long time. Yes, it is. And they'll rebuild a new one every year. Yeah. I don't discover my Oriole nests. I've occasionally find them while they're active, but they tuck them away so well in those dangling branches with all the leaves that I usually don't see them until fall when the leaves are all down and you realize where they actually built. You know, I'll see them at the feeder. I'll see them flying around the backyard here, but they tuck away that nest pretty well. Even now, they're still visible. You'll see them in the trees, and even if you're driving down some of the roads, you may see one hanging right over a road or right next to it. So you can see what they did last year, and they may come back to a similar area again this year. If it worked for them last year, they'll be probably using a similar area again.
Connie in Portage will go to you next. Hi, Connie.
Good morning, Larry. Last year we had up on French Creek in, outside of Portage, we had a pair of swans, and they built a nest on top of a muskrat house, and we sort of, every time we would by, would stop and watch. And they raised two chicks, and the marsh behind it was real big. And so we didn't see them only a couple more times. And then this year, now the pair has come back, but we've only seen them one time. And we were wondering what's going on. We've never seen swans down here before.
Okay. Well, these are the trumpeter swans. And right now we may have in Wisconsin both the trumpeter swan and the tundra swans are migrating through. The old name for them was whistling swan. Those tundra swans will be heading way to the north and northwest. Some will go to Hudson Bay to nest, others all the way to Alaska. And so rather than making a typical north-south migration, they're coming from the East Coast, largely along that Chesapeake Bay area. And for the last couple of weeks now, we've been watching big flocks crossing Wisconsin. They're scattered across both upland fields and shallow marshes and lake areas, where they're fattening up and then be heading up across the Dakotas and eventually to their nesting ground. The trumpeter swan is a bird that was gone from Wisconsin, and it wasn't until the 1980s and 90s that we started to reintroduce them. My good friend Sumner Madison spent the last 30-some years working on the trumpeter swan reintroduction program. We started originally releasing them in far northwest Wisconsin, and that's because the Department of Natural Resources in Minnesota had started a few years earlier reintroduction program outside of the Twin Cities. So we thought we could bolster their population. We then started some releases of the trumpeter swans in central Wisconsin. And once that population became established, they've been nesting on their own very successfully. And that growing population is starting to spread into new places. We actually tried one of the very last releases of swans at Horicon Marsh, and we had tagged those birds, and they just did not come back. But we now have them nesting on the marsh, and that's simply because others found their way there as the young from the previous releases. And so they're spreading around different places in Wisconsin. I would guess that if your lake is a small area and maybe the muskrats just did not have the vegetation to build a decent hut as an island this year, or muskrat populations also have a boom bust, they may have declined very seriously, and you just don't have the available nest site, they may seek something else out. So yeah, island sites are really the most favorable places because, of course, the ground predators, especially raccoons, can be a problem for them.
And thanks very much again, Connie, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Gary in Ween, Wisconsin. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Larry. Great show as always. I live about 20 miles northwest of the George W. Meade Wildlife Area, and it's also maybe about 55 miles north of the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge. a few years ago, we were down at the Nisida, and we got to see three whooping cranes. Now, they have a very nice visitor center there, and there's the Sandhill State Wildlife Area right north of it, and the Meadow Valley State Wildlife Area just south of it. But about 3 years ago, we were hiking in the Mead Wildlife Area, and we're looking across one of the big marshes, and there's this bright white object. And I said, well, that's totally out of place. And I was looking with my binoculars. And as we got closer, here it was a whooping crane surrounded by about 50 sandhills. And it was just so cool. So we hiked back out to the nearest road, and then we came from a different direction where we could get closer, and we're in a more wooded area. And my wife, who has a very nice camera, got these fantastic shots of the whooper with its mouth open and all these sand, and it stood like, I don't know, a foot and a half taller than the sandhills, but it was just such a neat thing to observe.
Oh, yeah, that's great, isn't it, Bill?
Wonderful experience. Whooping crane is the tallest bird in North America. It is a critically endangered species. And for many years, there was only one wild population, and that was a small group of birds that wintered along the Texas coast around the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge and flew way up into west central Canada, right along the Northwest Territories border at Wood Buffalo National Park as a nesting ground. And so we had literally all these birds in one single flock, and there was a big fear that if anything happened, say an oil spill or other disaster on the wintering grounds, disease outbreak or serious weather events, that this may put in danger already what was a very isolated, very small population. So we started with introduction attempts over the last about 30 years or so. There was an attempt out at Grays Lake, Idaho, to bring whooping cranes there. Turned out that was too close to the migrants. They mingled with them again. So Wisconsin became the site to establish a second population. And that was the Nisida release. We did find, however, that those birds are at the peak of their incubation right when the black flies hatch. And sometimes these birds, these insects can be of such a nuisance, birds have been known to abandon their nest. So we do have an established population out at Nisida. They're doing as best as they can. We moved some of that over to the White River Marsh area as a captive rearing and release program. And we're also releasing some at Horicon Marsh in the National Wildlife Refuge. So we are continuing to gather eggs from captive birds, rear them, and put them out to bolster a second population. And you might know that we were teaching these birds originally a new migratory route from Wisconsin to Florida by using ultralight airplanes. We assume that now there's enough whooping cranes that are making that flight. If we put them out there and they mingle with others, they'll show them the route. So this has been a long-term effort to try to bring them back. These, again, like our sandhills, it takes many years before they mature and even begin the nest. And so it's been kind of a delicate effort. But the population has been increasing. It's been quite successful. And the chance to actually see whooping cranes, even beyond these few release sites, is becoming a little bit more common as birds are wandering around this time of the year.
And Gary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Great to have him with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, retired wildlife educator and naturalist Bill Volkert. Great to have him along, and thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online. Let's take a call from Ray in Milwaukee next. Ray, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I was out walking my dog, and I guess it was around the last week of February, first week of March, on Milwaukee's east side, and I was on Newberry Boulevard and Lake Drive, and I noticed the biggest bird I've ever seen in my life flying north on Lake Drive. about tree level. And as the bird got over me, the wingspan was probably twice the size of a big crow. So this was a giant bird. And when it flew over me, I noticed it had a white head. Was I looking at a bald eagle? And did anybody else on the east side see that about 2-3 weeks back?
Oh, I bet it was.
Think, Bill? Oh, yeah, and it's becoming actually a fairly common sight. I think a lot of us remember when we were kids, if you wanted to see a bald eagle, you had to drive to northern Wisconsin and cross your fingers that you actually came across one. They have made such a comeback. We have them nesting in almost every county of Wisconsin. Our bald eagle nesting population is over 1,700 pair just in Wisconsin. They've really made quite the comeback, and it is no longer uncommon, and I don't mean just uncommon in the northern part of the state, anywhere. You can see them flying over. And so Milwaukee County is one of the few places where we don't have them nesting because of the large urban population and land use changes there. But as a migrant, not uncommon, and the fact that it was perhaps flying up and following along the Lake Michigan shore, not unexpected at all. So, no. This is something that is really quite a common sight, and not far from Milwaukee, you've got nesting pairs of them right around that area.
I was walking in my own neighborhood along the Lake Monona and looked up, and 20 feet away from me in a tree, at the top of the tree, was a bald eagle sitting there looking out on the lake. It's quite a...
Always a majestic sight, but no longer that uncommon. It's great. And this has really been one of our success stories for the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah. Ray, thanks again. Appreciate the call. David in St. Croix County, it's your turn.
Hi, Sam. I'm hoping somebody from the Crane Foundation is listening, because Bill had mentioned the whooping crane is holding their own, but in reality... So we've had a pair in St. Croix County that's attempted to bring off colts for the last 6 years, and every year the nest or the young colt is killed by predators. And I've suggested some kind of nest protection. You'd be surprised how effective poultry netting can be just in a chicken yard, keeping fox and coons out. And that's what's mainly coyotes and fox and coon are killing these young colts. The young cranes. And it's just disappointing that we have no natural reproduction, and they can see that year after year, and there's not some sort of intervention that we can do. And on the other note, I will say I really truly have learned that we were once prey. The other day I had a pair of sandhill cranes come over my head. I wasn't expecting it, and they made their call, and I literally hit the ground. And I'll just say it scared me to a surprise, and it just showed me that back in the day we weren't the number one creature on Earth.
As a matter of fact, we had some folks on from the Crane Foundation. George Archibald, for example, was on. He was mentioned. He was on last week when we talked about what was going on with the Crane Foundation. But go ahead, Bill. You were going to comment.
Well, I mean, it would be really nice to provide that kind of intensive management or care for a single pair. But that's really, a matter of time and expense to do that, to track it down. And, when we have a population that's very small, each individual really counts. As populations start to show some recovery, there's always going to be losses in nature, but you're counting your odds that you have enough survivorship and reproduction that you are adding to the population and we're seeing a recovery. So I think it's really a matter of just resource allocation. They're outside of, and you said St. Croix County, outside of the main focal area for management, and we've got a few scattered pair like that. I guess you cross your fingers and hope for the best. But, yeah, predators are always going to be a problem, especially for a ground nesting bird and for young that are vulnerable before they're able to take flight. It would be nice to be able to provide that direct guardianship. But, as I say, it's just a matter of, personnel and money to be able to do that. So it's the focal area for the releases that we're really concentrating right now.
Let's take another call. Dennis, in Altoona. Hi, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. For the last year, I've had crows in my back. Well, there's usually crows around. But last year, something came up. I don't know what. But they started chasing the squirrels, and they're still doing it. And I wonder if you could tell me, is that kind of normal behavior?
Not normal at all. But, you know, crows and their relatives, ravens, are some of the smartest birds. They've got a very complex vocabulary. They're in flocks, which means there's also quite an involved social behavior among them. And we do know this among ravens, that some of the things they do can only be described or defined as play. There's no real reason. We've seen them actually sliding down snow hills and doing things, throwing objects in the air, as if it's just a matter of just kicks. It's just fun. So chasing a squirrel, it's nothing that's a food source for them. It's nothing that, well, they may get into a nest, so they may try to harass it there. Or maybe they're just enjoying harassing them because they can. I would say the only reason might be if you've got a squirrel that is getting into a nest, and crows are earlier nesters, so there may be a deliberate attempt to keep them out. Or maybe they're just harassing them because they can. There's not always a clear explanation for some of this bird behavior.
There you go, Dennis. Thank you, Dennis, for calling. Paul in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi there, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Nice to meet you, Bill. I've never met you, but I know you from WSO.
No, and here's my pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, here's my query. I'm on a cold case since July of 2019 from a marsh near Sherwood in Calumet County. Would you be able to identify this following call? And pardon my imitation, so here it goes.
Okay.
It's rather raspy but rhythmic. Does that sound like anything to you?
First thing that comes to my mind is Carolina Wren. There's a,
really?
a chattering call. And Carolina Wren, we normally think of as a bird that's farther south, but they keep moving north in Wisconsin, a well-established Madison, La Crosse area. I had one last year winter around the house. Once the weather got nice, he disappeared, probably a pioneer, an individual. And we're starting to see more reports of that. Like I say, it's the first thing that comes to my mind. I will have to say that when I hear people's attempts to imitate bird calls, we can get the rhythm and some sort of a hint of the voice, but it's oftentimes in my ears that real quality of the voice. And some birds can have a pretty similar call, so you fine tune your listening a little bit, but as I say, I'm just a guess right now. That's the first one that comes to mind. Take a look if that isn't around. They can be a little bit of a skulker, hang around some of the thickets and areas. And the one that was around my house, I would see it occasionally, but I would hear it quite regularly. So, As I say, a little bit of a guess here, but that's the first thing that I can think of.
There you go, Paul. Thank you very much. Mary in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to ask, should I be putting anything out for the robins who've made their way back? I just watched a robin unsuccessfully pecking at the frozen earth. And should there be any food put out for the robins? So that's my question.
Okay, you could try mealworms. Some of the bird stores, Wild Birds Unlimited and other types of shops, they carry both live and dried of mealworms. I know some people have tried raisins or cut pieces of fruit. A lot of the robins, they may peck in the uplands and the ground might yet be frozen, but I will see them go down to the edge of wetlands and along some of the edges of rivers where the ground is warming up and thawing out. In fact, I saw a large flock in the dead of winter along the lower Wisconsin River backwaters where there's a little open water flowing from a spring or some backwater from the river. And they were gathered around that and apparently spent the entire winter there and finding enough food. So, food right now may be a little bit scattered for them, but they're usually pretty good at finding it. The bigger concern for early migrants are these late spring storms and weather events.
And a few years ago, we had the Phoebes that had arrived, and we had a real severe cold snap, and we literally lost a lot of Phoebes and bluebirds during that type of weather. So that could be an emergency food supply from them.
Yeah, it could be as well. And just Chris in Mount Horbit emailed, they had Robin stay with them through the winter. In January, they saw 50 to 75 robins around their backyard. This was prior to the February cold snap. And so they will, sometimes they'll stay, they'll either come back earlier or they'll stay right through the winter. So it's really, really interesting. Well, Phil in Lake Delton called to say that he heard the first loon pass through the Lake Delton area. So that's good to hear. And we've got some more reports from folks as well, and we'll get to some of them as we move along here today with our guest. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, always great to have him with us on the show. And he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Bill. Thanks for listening. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for listening today to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator. It's been a lot of fun talking with him every time he visits. And today we're kind of zeroing in on the migrating birds, but taking your questions and maybe your experiences as well. We'd love to hear from you. So what questions do you have about our birds? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Reggie in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, so I'm a delivery person by profession, so I'm always outside. And I find myself trying to imitate the Cardinals' call. And I was just wondering, am I actually communicating with those Cardinals, or is it just in my head? Because I feel like they follow me around. I don't know. I was just wondering.
Okay. Bill,
question,
what do you think?
Actually, a Cardinal is one, as we said earlier, it's got that clear whistle, and it's one of the birds I think that's fairly easy for people to imitate if you can do a good whistle. I'm sure they probably respond to that to some degree. If we can do a pretty good imitation, they may think that that is another cardinal out there and perhaps a competitor in the neighborhood. So perhaps they are actually responding to you. I've tried that just as much, calling back to them. And sometimes it is a little bit vague. Are they just continuously calling? If I just stop, do they call just as much, or are they actually responding to me? And I think sometimes, you know, there are individual differences of those birds and different circumstances. So maybe they're actually responding directly to us, especially a good imitation. Like I say, I've also tried it where I call and I think they're talking to me, and then I just stop and they seem to call just as much. So maybe they're ignoring me. A little hard to say, but it is communication. So I think somebody who can whistle a good tune, perhaps we can at least provoke them a little bit.
And Kathy in Medford wondered, that first call we played of the Cardinal may have been the Cardinal call, but the song is what we were really thinking about. And Christina played that song. She wondered if you could talk, maybe discuss the differences between a song, a bird song, and a bird call.
Oh, that's an excellent question. Yeah, now bird calls are the communications that birds will do among each other throughout the year. So these may be what we refer to as contact calls. So when chickadees are moving through the woods, that chickadee-dee-dee is actually a call. So they're just staying in touch with each other. They're busy looking for food. They're just, so they're not always watching each other, but they're moving through as kind of a dispersed flock. So it's basically saying, hey, over here, everything's good, no problem, here I am, and keep your eyes out. And then there may be warning calls. And there are also low and high intensity warning calls among a lot of birds. So a red-winged blackbird's a common one. When you first approach, you might hear a little check, check, check. And that's sort of a watch it, look out, something's coming. And then when you hear that real sharp descending whistle, that is more an alert call, a danger, danger. Birds may even notify others when there's some food found. So these are things where they're staying in touch, they're watching for food, watching for danger, and these will be usually the shorter little chips, whistles, calls that we hear. Chickadees are unusual because they have a very complex vocabulary, and for them, the song is actually more simplified, for most birds, songs tend to be more complex vocalizations. So getting back to the cardinal, usually their contact calls and warning calls are sharp chips. Some people describe it as almost a metallic, a real sharp. And there's a real accent to that. Those are the calls. The songs are really serving a couple of purposes. This is during the nesting season. This is where the males will first announce and establish a territory. So right now, the male red-winged blackbirds are coming back first. And that's typical of most birds. The males arrive first, and then as they spread out, they look for a territory. So they're staking their claim. They're saying, this is my place. I'm taking this. Get out of here, or you're going to have to challenge me. And the challenge is usually with another bird coming in and calling and singing and trying to establish that territory, or a deliberate chase where they'll try to drive them out. Once they've settled down, and you can see this over a marsh, the red-winged blackbirds are almost evenly spaced. They've all got their place staked, and then as the females come, they continue to sing, and that same song serves a second purpose, which is not to tell other males, hey, get out of here, this is my backyard, but also for the female, I've got a place, it's available, I've got prime real estate here, you know, you're welcome. And sometimes among the red-winged blackbirds, which I've really been fascinated with, when they first arrive, you'll hear a two-note call. So it's sort of a gurree, gurree. When the females come, then they add that more complex oogalee, the three notes. And it's my belief, I've talked to some other ornithologists about it, that it seems to be that the two-note is directed at other males, and then the oogalee, it's sort of embedding in there for the males to keep up, but then the attractive vocalization for the female trying to lure her. So songs are really for mating and courtship and territory defense, and calls are given throughout the year for a number of different purposes, for communication, safety, warnings, and things like that.
Hmm. Excellent description
and
there.
By the way, that's what makes listening to birds really very complicated, because first of all, some birds, like cardinals, will have a lot of variations on the song, but you can hear the voice, and then you'll hear a call note, which will be completely distinct, and to learn all the vocalizations of even common birds can really be a challenge, but it's a great way because they're easier to hear than they are to see, and it's fun to tune up your ears and try to just listen to that music of nature.
Take another call. Sylvia in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's been a while, Bill. I'd have one quick comment on the bluebird housing. Please do not face the opening towards the road for that gentleman that had called in earlier. I've seen bluebirds swooping out of the houses and could be right in front of a car. And the second comment I have is on your last program with Larry, there was somebody called in about declining gray jay populations. Mm-hmm. I discovered a study done in Canada that these gray jays are food cachers, and the warmer weather is apparently spoiling their food caches, and they're not being able to feed their nestlings. They've been finding dead nestlings in the warmer winters.
That's interesting, study results. Yeah, well, changing environments and changing climates are certainly putting a whole new mix into some of the challenges for birds. And so, yeah, it's becoming a very complex world. There's a lot of different birds out there. Some are doing quite well, and some are recovering, especially some through our deliberate efforts, like the whooping crane, trumpeter swan, and other birds we're managing. And others are declining, just having a more difficult time in this changing world. The big hope in conservation is to keep them all there. We've been lucky enough to have such a rich world with 10,000 species of birds. It would be a shame to lose any of them. And so conservations are certainly trying to do this all over the world to keep them there, in spite of the fact that the face of this planet keeps changing because of us.
And thank you very much, Sylvia, for your comments. Appreciate it. Day in South Elgin emailed to ask if Horican Marsh is still loaded with lead birdshot. A number of years ago, a swam languished in Illinois on the Fox in the water, suffering from lead poisoning, it turns out. Any comments on that, Bill?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to. First of all, swans, as really large birds, are incredibly susceptible to lead poisoning. Just a pellet or two can start to show some real serious effects on their health and condition. And it doesn't take all that many to actually kill a bird of that size. So it's easily dissolved into crop as lead salts into the bloodstream and can lead to toxic poisoning. Now, lead shot has been banned for overwater hunting since the early 1990s. So I think it was 92 that we had the national ban on that. So we're talking about almost 30 years that lead shot has been banned in these areas. It's steel only or bismuth. And the difference is that, yes, lead does not, say, break down. It can persist there for a long, long time. But in places like Horican Marsh, it's a soft bottom marsh. So this tends to settle out fairly easily, get out of reach of a lot of the birds that feed on the bottom. And also the unfortunate thing is that we have a high siltation rate because of surrounding farmland and other land uses that are filling the marsh very slowly. That does cover it. It's the hard bottom, marl bottom lakes where this can sit there and be exposed to the reach of diving ducks and swans for an extremely long time. So it does depend on that substrate, that bottom of the wetland, as to how long that lead will persist where it is accessible or reachable to any of the birds.
Joe in Viroqua will give you a chance. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. I've had a thrill this past season of having red-breasted nuthatches along with the white-breasted and also tufted titmouse that are feeding on sunflower seeds. Now, when it comes to the goldfinches, I used to have two dozen or more in my yard at one time. In the past couple of years, there's only been two or three goldfinches at a time, and I thought I would blame it on the fact that maybe this thistle seed was stale. So I started buying thistle seed just 1 or 2 pounds of bulk at a time. And the goldfinches also eat sunflower seeds, which was to my amazement. And last but not least, robins like to eat various berries during winter. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right.
Yeah, thank
Comment,
you.
Bill.
Yeah, very good. Yes, that was excellent. Some good hints there. Yeah, for the goldfinches we mentioned earlier, this has been kind of an odd year. There's been a very scattered population, and I also have not seen a lot of them here. But as he mentioned, nitrous seed or thistle, yes, it can spoil. That's the first cause that we should look for to make sure that we're buying smaller quantities, especially from stores that have a good turnover rate so this stuff doesn't sit on the shelf for months. So that is the first thing to look at. And, yeah, this year is just an odd year, even with fresh nitrous seed out there. The birds just are not here in abundance this year. We'll see as the migration goes on, they start to move back in again. And as he mentioned, sunflower seed, and especially shelled sunflower, can be quite an attractant for goldfinches. Red-breasted and white-breasted nuthatches. The red-breasted is a little bit more migratory, and they will eventually move to more of the conifer forest, where white-breasted tends to be a year-round resident in the deciduous forest, the broadleaf forests. And tufted titmouse is actually following the trend right along with Carolina chickadee. They've been advancing north and becoming better established in the southern part of Wisconsin and moving up the western side of the state. So here's a population that is becoming, it is a relative, by the way, to the chickadee. So they're starting to advance a little bit further north and more people are seeing them.
Well, thank you very much for that. I want to get Kathy a note from Kathy in Black Creek. She emailed that the Bluebird Association birdhouses they can't offer them. They've run completely out and don't have enough volunteers to make more. So what they've done is they've put up plans for people to assemble their own boxes. And so they've got some good plans for them. And so if you go to Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, BRAW, you can get those plants. So I wanted to bring
that. Yeah, that's great. It must have been too good of a deal. They had a real run on that. But, you can easily make your own, and that'll work well. You know, Larry, I do want to mention that in addition to putting up bluebird houses or getting ready with some of our feeders that we've been maintaining with seed over the wintertime, and also, say, getting ready for the orioles in another month and a half here with the jelly and oranges, the other important thing that I think we really need to do is to look at our backyards to make them more bird-friendly. I know you do a regular gardening show, talk about all kinds of gardening, but now is a great time to do your planning and get ready for some of the different kinds of things you want to add to your backyard to make it more bird-friendly. And we can think about food plants and shelter plants, anything from a rain garden, butterfly garden, which also works for hummingbirds, to providing some shrubs, trees, and shelter for them. And I could give you a lot of hints on things that you could plant, but my suggestion is a few sites that you might want to check up and do some research. The National Wildlife Federation has a website, and it has a native plant finder. You just put in your zip code, and they will match it to that growing area and a whole list of flowers, shrubs, and trees that you can plant that provide for birds. Also, the native landscaping group called Wild Ones. They also have some good hints of using native plants that will be beneficial for wildlife. And if you're in the Port Washington area, the Great Lakes Bird Observatory, they have a natural habitat improvement project for people there to help them make their backyards more bird-friendly. And they're also working with them to do research to see just what birds are they attracting and are they really providing a habitat for more birds that's more successful and actually successfully nesting and raising their young there. So we want to see not just the assumption is like the old adage of you build it, it'll come, but who's going to come and how well do they do? So some good hints there. And now is a good time. I know the gardeners are getting ready. Think about the birds, too. Do some gardening to help them out and make your backyard a bird-friendly habitat, both for migrants to stop over that you can enjoy and for some summer birds to nest right there around your house.
Very good points, Bill. I'm glad you brought them up. Let's take another call. Kay in Prairie du Chien. Let's go to you. Hi, Kay.
Hello, Mary. Thanks for taking my call. I used to have a lot of birds around here. The last couple of years, I've noticed quite a decline. I hardly had any birds out here this winter. And it seems I have seen a hawk. I didn't get a good enough look to what it was, but I know last year I was standing out in my backyard, and all of a sudden I heard this whoosh, and it was chasing a turtle dove. I have found feathers in my yard from different kind of birds. It ate my mama robin that had been on her nest. There's just hardly any birds here, and it has been around this area, I'm sure, for some time, but there's hardly any birds around, and every once in a while I'll see it looks like a baby rabbit tail might be laying in the yard.
That could be an owl, too, if it's comment on that, Bill?
Yeah, the most common predator on birds is going to be the Cooper's hawk. First of all, keep in mind, Cooper's hawks and songbirds have lived side by side for thousands of years. And so, they have to eat too. It becomes a little disheartening when you see them take something like a cardinal right off a bird feeder. There, you have to take a look that we're really kind of setting them up or bringing in the birds to the feeder, and that makes easy hunting for the Cooper's hawk. If you should have a bird like that making a habit, I would suggest to shut your feeder down for about 2 weeks, let the songbirds disperse a bit, and let the Cooper's hawk move on as his luck declines. It can be a little bit more of a very localized problem if you have a pair of Cooper's hawks that are nesting right in the neighborhood. So they're, of course, going to be hunting right nearby. It can be a little bit difficult. They're opportunists, though. They're just going to take what they can, and they're kind of culling a little bit out of the flock to take the most vulnerable or unfortunate ones. But they're really not going to, say, be having a major impact on the population. If that were the case, these birds would have been gone a long time ago before we even arrived. So it is part of nature's balance. There's always going to be predators and prey out there. It just turns out that most of it goes unseen. When it happens right in your backyard, it's a little bit more of a visible drama, and you realize there is some cruelty in nature. But that's the way it's always been. It's the jungle out there.
It is indeed.
And as far as the rabbit goes, now that can be a prey for the Cooper's hawk. It's a pretty powerful bird. But as you mentioned, great horned owl, that's a pretty common prey for them. I will see rabbits under my Niger feeder. They'll come in at night and pick up the waste grain that's laying down there and then some of the other smaller millet grain. And that also can be easy hunting for great horned owls. And great horned owls, they're not just out in the countryside. They'll be right in the cities. And they may just take advantage of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Nikki in Milwaukee emailed to ask if there's anything to fishing and bird watching. Do you think it helps or hinders bird watching, or does it make any difference?
Fishing? Okay.
Well, fishing, I think this calls, making your own calls or having recorded calls.
Yep. Okay, a couple of things. What bird watchers call pishing, it is that sound, sort of a wishing sound. So it may be a sharp psh, 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 psh. And you will find some of the first birds that are attracted that are chickadees. And bird watchers will do this quite commonly, and I certainly am guilty of it, if there's any guilt there. I do it quite by habit. It gets their attention. If the chickadees start to get curious, other birds follow chickadees. Remember what I said earlier, they move through the woods, they're curious, they're watchful, and they keep in touch with each other. It's not unusual to watch a flock of dispersed chickadees go through the woods and following behind downy woodpecker, other songbirds, nuthatches. They use the chickadees as a lookout. And so you do a little pishing, it stirs up the flock. They may come in so you can see what's locally around. And what I find is usually they come in, they get a look, they realize I'm the one making the noise, and then they just move on. Now, bird watchers also will use recordings of birds. And here, it's better than imitation. We're actually using a electronic reproduction of that call. And so we're playing back their own voice, and they do respond to it. The problem is, especially during nesting seasons or with endangered species, small populations, or vulnerable birds, this can literally interfere with their nesting success and raising of their families. There have, for example, been some places, first one I think of is down in Arizona where there's a small population of trogons. They have absolutely banned any electronic calls because these few birds are being harassed by one bird after another who wanted to lure the bird out and see it. And the bird thinks that now there's competition. There's everybody's out there trying to get my place. They're calling and they're interfering with the family. And so it's got to be used with extreme discretion. And I would say use those recordings for reference for yourself. Let's not mess with the birds. They've got enough to keep busy with.
Bill Volker, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Bill is a retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He comes by every so often to be with us. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow, the Larry Mealer Show Book Club starts out. We'll be talking about The Geography of Bliss by Eric Weiner. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mealer.